He hadn't thought he could sleep, but he did, exhausted with pain. It was a restless sleep, though, filled with violent, fragmentary dreams and broken by the constant illusion of being strangled. In the morning, they set off again. No question of riding this time. He walked, and as fast as he could. The noose was left around his neck, hanging loose, but a short length of rope bound his wrists to the harness leathers of one of the horses. He stumbled and fell several times, but managed to scramble to his feet, in spite of bruises and aching muscles. He had the distinct impression that they would allow him to be dragged without compunction if he didn't. They were heading roughly north. He could tell as much by the sun. Not that that helped a lot, since he had no notion where they'd started from. Still, they could be no great distance from Fraser's Ridge. He couldn't have been unconscious for more than a few hours. He looked at the churning hoofs of the horse beside him, trying to estimate its speed. No more than 2 or 3 miles per hour. He was managing to keep up without great strain. Landmarks. There was no telling where they meant to take him, or why. But if he was ever to get back, he had to memorize the shape of the terrain through which they passed. A cliff, 40 feet high and overgrown with shaggy plants. A twisted persimmon tree protruding from a crack in the rock like a jack-in-the-box, popping out, covered in bright orange bobbles. They emerged onto the crest of a ridge, to a breathtaking view of distant mountains, 3 sharp peaks clustered together against a blazing sky, the left one higher than the other two. He could remember that. A stream, a river, that fell through a small gorge. They drove the horses through a shallow ford, soaking Roger to the waist in icy water. The routine of travel lasted for days, moving ever northward. His captors didn't talk to him, and by the fourth day he realized that he was beginning to lose track of time, falling into a dreamlike trance, overcome by fatigue and the silence of the mountains. He pulled a long thread from the hem of his coat and began to knot it, one knot for each day, both as some small hold on reality and as a crude method of estimating the distance travelled. He was going back. Whatever it took, he was going back to Fraser's Ridge. It was on the 8th day that he found his chance. They were high in the mountains by now. They had crossed through one pass the day before and come down a steep slope, the ponies grunting, slowing to brace each careful step as the loads on their saddles creaked and shifted. Now they were headed up again, and the ponies slowed their pace still further as the ground sloped sharply upward. Roger was able to gain a little ground, to pull even with the pony's side and cling to the harness leather, letting the tough little beast pull him along. The Indians had dismounted, walking and leading the ponies. He kept a narrow eye on the long black scalp lock hanging down the back of the brave leading the pony he clung to. He held on with one hand. The other was busy, under cover of a hanging flap of canvas, picking at the knot that bound him to the harness. Strand by strand, the hemp came free, until no more than a single thread of rope held him to the pony. He waited, sweat streaming down his ribs from fear and the effort of the climb, rejecting one opportunity after another, worrying from moment to moment that he had left it too late, that they would stop to make camp, that the brave who led his pony would turn and see him, would think to check. But they didn't stop, and the brave didn't turn. There, he thought, and his heart beat fast, seeing the first pony in the string step out along a narrow deer trail cut into the hillside. The ground fell away sharply below the trail, then levelled out about 6 feet down. Below was a thickly wooded slope, ideal for concealment. One pony, then another, negotiated the narrow stretch of trail, putting down their feet with finicking care. A third, and then it was Roger's turn. He squeezed in close to the pony's side, smelling the sweet, pungent foam of its sweat. One step, then another, and they were on the narrow trail. He jerked the rope loose and jumped. He hit with a jolt and sank halfway to his knees, sprang up and ran downhill. His shoes came off and he left them behind. He splashed across a tiny creek, scrabbled up its bank on hands and knees, and clambered to his feet, running before he'd got upright. He heard calls behind him, then silence, but knew he was pursued. He had no breath to waste. Neither would they. The landscape slid past in a blur of leaves and rocks as he swung his head from side to side, looking for which way to go, some place to hide. He chose a grove of birch, burst through and into a sloping meadow, careened down across the slippery grass, bare feet stubbing on roots and rocks. At the far side, he took a second to glance back. Two of them. He saw the round, dark heads among the leaves. On into another copse, out again, zigzagging madly through a field of broken rocks, breath coming hard in his throat. One thing the bloody past had done for him, he thought grimly, improved his wind. Then there was no room for any thought, nothing but the blind instincts of flight. And down again, a scrambling drop down the wet, cracked face of a 20-foot cliff, grabbing at the plants as he half fell past them, roots ripping, hands sinking into pockets of mud, blunting his fingers on unseen rocks. He landed hard at the bottom, bent over, gasping. One of them was right behind him, coming backward down the cliff. He snatched off the noose still around his neck and whipped it hard at the Indian's hands. The man's hold slipped. He let go and slithered down, landing askew. Roger flung the noose over the man's head, gave it a vicious yank, and fled, leaving the man on his knees, choking and clawing at the rope round his neck. Trees. He needed cover. He vaulted a fallen log, stumbled and rolled, was up again, running. Up. A spruce thicket, up a little way. Heart labouring, he jabbed his feet down hard, bounding up the slope. He flung himself into the spruces, fighting through the pricks of a million needles, blind, eyes shut against the lashing twigs. Then the ground gave way underneath him, and he fell in a blur of sky and branches. He hit, half-curled, his breath knocked out, had barely sense to curl up further and keep on rolling, bashing off rocks and saplings, setting off showers of dirt and fallen needles, bouncing and smashing his way to the bottom. He fetched up with a crash and a tangle of woody stems, hung a moment, then slid down to end with a thud. Dazed and bleeding, he lay still for a moment, then rolled painfully onto his side, wiping dirt and blood from his face. He looked up, searching. There they were, the two of them, at the top of the slope, coming carefully down beside the ledge he had fallen from. On hands and knees, he dived between the woody stems and crawled for his life. Twigs bent, sharp ends jabbed him, and cascades of dust, dead leaves and insects fell from the higher branches above as he heaved his way forward, forcing a passage through the close-grown stems, twisting and turning, following such openings as he found. Hell, was his first coherent thought. Then he realized that it was as much a description as curse. He was in a rhododendron hell. With that belated realization, he slowed his flight, if crawling at roughly 10 feet per hour could be called flight. The tunnel-like opening in which he found himself was too narrow to allow him to turn around, but he managed to see behind him by thrusting his head to one side and craning his neck. There was nothing there, nothing but damp and musty darkness, illumined by a faint scatter of light, swirling with dust motes. Nothing was visible but the stems and limber branches of the rhododendron thicket. His shaking limbs gave way, and he collapsed. He lay for a moment, curled up between the stems, breathing the musk of rotting leaves and damp earth.
"You wanted cover, mate," he murmured to himself.
Things were beginning to hurt. He was ripped and bleeding in a dozen places. Even in the dim light, the ends of his fingers looked like raw meat. He took a slow inventory of the damage, listening all the while for sounds of pursuit. Not surprisingly, there were none. He had heard talk about rhododendron hells in the taverns in Cross Creek, half-boasting stories of hunting dogs who had chased a squirrel into one of the huge tangles and become hopelessly lost, never to be seen again. Roger hoped there was a fair amount of exaggeration to these stories, though a good look around wasn't reassuring. What light there was had no direction. Anyway he looked the same. Drooping clusters of cool, leathery leaves, thick stems and slender branches laced together in a nearly impenetrable snarl. With a slight feeling of panic, he realized he had no idea from which direction he had come. He put his head on his knees and breathed deeply, trying to think. All right, first things first. His right foot was bleeding freely from a deep gash on the edge of the sole. He took off his tattered stockings and used one to bind his foot. Nothing else seemed bad enough to need a bandage, save the shallow gouge in his scalp. That was still seeping blood, wet and sticky to his touch. His hands were shaking. It was hard to tie the stocking round his head. Still, the small action made him feel better. Now then, he'd climbed countless Munros in Scotland, those endless craggy peaks, and more than once had helped to find day-trippers lost among the rocks and heather. If you were lost in the wilderness, the usual caution was to stay put, wait for someone to find you. That would seem not to apply, he thought, if the only people looking for you were ones you didn't want to be found by. He looked upward through the snarl of branches. He could see small patches of sky, but the rhododendrons rose nearly 12 feet over his head. There was no way to stand up. He could barely sit upright under the interlacing branches. There was no way of telling how big this particular hell was. On their journey through the mountains, he'd seen entire slopes covered with heath balds, valleys filled with the deep green of rhododendron, only a few ambitious trees protruding above the waving sea of leaves. Then again they had detoured around small tangles of the stuff, no more than 100 feet square. He knew he was fairly close to one edge of the thing, but that knowledge was useless, with no idea in which direction the edge lay. He became aware that he was very cold, his hands still shaking.
Shock, he thought dimly. What did you do for shock?
Hot liquids, blankets, brandy.
Yeah, right.
Elevate the feet. That much he could do. He scooped a shallow, awkward little depression and eased himself into it, scraping the clammy, half-rotted leaves over his chest and shoulders. He propped his heels in the fork of a stem and closed his eyes, shivering.
They wouldn't come in after him. Why should they?
A lot better to wait if they were in no hurry.
He'd have to come out eventually, if he still could.
Any movement here below would shake the leaves above and pinpoint his movements to the watchers.
That was a cold thought. They undoubtedly knew where he was now and were simply waiting for his next move.
The patches of sky were the deep blue of sapphires. It was still afternoon. He would wait till dark before he moved then. Hands clasped together on his chest, he willed himself to rest, to think of something beyond his present situation. Brianna. Let him think of her, without the rage or bewilderment now.
There was no time for that.
Let him pretend that all was still between them as it had been on that night, their night, warm against him in the dark, her hand so frank and curious, eager on his body, the generosity of her nakedness freely given, and his momentary, mistaken conviction that all was forever right with the world. Gradually the shivering eased, and he slept. He woke some time after moonrise. He could see brightness suffusing the sky, though not the moon itself. He was stiff and cold and very sore. Hungry, too, and with a desperate thirst. Well, if he got himself out of this bloody tangle, at least he could find water. Streams were everywhere in these mountains. Feeling awkward as a turtle on its back, he turned slowly over. One direction was as good as another. On hands and knees, he started off, pushing through crevices, breaking branches, trying his best to go in a straight line. One fear haunted him more than thought of the Indians. He could so easily lose his bearings, moving blindly through this maze. He could end by going in endless circles, trapped forever. The stories of the hunting dogs had lost any element of exaggeration. Some small animal ran over his hand, and he jerked. hitting his head on the branches overhead. He gritted his teeth and kept on, a few inches at a time. Crickets chirped all around him, and countless small rustlings let him know that the inhabitants of this particular hell didn't appreciate his intrusion. He couldn't see anything at all. It was almost pitch black here below. There was the one good thing, though. The constant effort heated him. Sweat stung the gouge in his scalp and dripped from his chin. Whenever he had to stop for breath, he listened for some clue to either his location or his pursuers. But he heard nothing beyond the occasional nightbird's call and the rustle of the leaves all around. He wiped his sweating face on his sleeve and pushed on. He didn't know how long he had been going when he found the rock, or not so much found it as ran head first into it. He reeled back, clutching his head and gritting his teeth to keep from crying out. Blinking from the pain, he put out a hand and found what he had struck. Not a boulder, a flat-faced rock. A tall one, too. The hard surface extended up as high as he could reach. He groped to the one side and made his way around the rock. There was a thick stem growing near it, his shoulders stuck in the narrow space between them. He wrenched and heaved, squirming, and finally shot forward, losing his balance and landing on his face. Doggedly, he rose up onto his hands again and realized that he could see his hands. He looked up and around in complete amazement. His head and shoulders protruded into a clear space. Not merely clear, but empty. Eagerly, he wriggled forward out of the claustrophobic grip of the rhododendrons. He was standing in an open space, facing a cliff wall that rose on the far side of a small clearing. It really was a clearing, too. Nothing at all grew in the soft dirt beneath his feet. Astonished, he turned slowly round, gulping great lungfuls of cold, sharp air. "My God in heaven," he said softly, aloud. The clearing was roughly oval in shape, ringed by standing stones, with one end of the oval closed by the cliff face. The stones were evenly spaced around the ring, a few of them fallen, a couple more dislodged from their places by the press of roots and stems behind them. He could see the dense black mass of the rhododendrons showing between and above the stones, but not one plant grew within the perimeter of the ring. Feeling the goose flesh ripple over his body, he walked softly toward the center of the ring. It couldn't be. But it was. And why not, after all? If Gillis Duncan had been right. He turned and saw in the moonlight the scratchings on the cliff face. He walked closer to look at them. There were several petroglyphs, some the size of his hand, others nearly as tall as he was, spiral shapes and what might be a bent man, dancing or dying. A nearly closed circle that looked like a snake chasing its tail. Warning signs. He shuddered again, and his hand went to the seam of his breeches. They were still there. The two gems he had risked his life to get. Tiny passports to safety, he hoped. For him and for Brianna. He could hear nothing. No humming, no buzzing. The autumn air was cold, a light wind stirring the rhododendron leaves. Damn, what was the date? He didn't know. Had lost track long since. He thought it had been near the beginning of September, though, when he left Brianna in Wilmington. It had taken much longer than he'd thought to track Bonnet and find an opportunity to steal the gems. It must be nearly the end of October now. The Feast of Samhain. The eve of All Hallows was nearly come, or only recently passed. Would this ring follow the same dates, though? He supposed that it would. If the Earth's lines of force shifted with its revolution around the sun, then all the passages should stand open or closed with the shift. He stepped closer to the cliff and saw it, an opening near the base of the cliff, a split in the rock, perhaps a cave. A chill ran over him that had nothing to do with the cold night wind. His fingers closed tightly over the small round hardness of the gems. He heard nothing, Was it open? If so...
Escape. It would be that.
Escape to when, though? And how? The words of Gili's spell chanted in his mind.
Garnet's rest and love about my neck. I will be faithful.
Faithful?
To try that avenue of escape was to abandon Brianna. And hasn't she abandoned you?
No, I'm damned if she has, he whispered to himself. There was some reason for what she'd done. He knew it.
She's found her parents. She'll be safe enough. And for this reason, a woman shall leave her parents and cleave to her husband.
Safety wasn't what mattered. Love was. If he'd cared for safety, he wouldn't have crossed that desperate void to begin with. His hands were sweating. He could feel the damp grain of the rough cloth under his fingers, and his torn fingertips burned and throbbed. He took one more step toward the split in the cliff face, his eyes fixed on the pitch black inside. If he didn't step inside... There were only two things to do. Go back to the suffocating grip of the rhododendrons, or try to scale the cliff before him. He tilted his head back to gauge its height. A face was looking down at him, featureless in the dark, silhouetted against the moon-bright sky. He hadn't time to move or think before the rope noose settled gently over his head and tightened, pressing his arms against his body. Chapter 52. Desertion. River Run, December 1769. It had been raining, and soon would be again. Drops of water hung trembling under the petals of the marble Jacobite roses on Hector Cameron's tomb, and the brick walk was dark with wet. Semper Fidelis, it said, beneath his name and dates. Semper Fi. She had dated a marine cadet once. He'd had it carved on the ring he had tried to give her. Always faithful. And who had Hector Cameron been faithful to? His wife? His prince? She hadn't spoken to Jamie Fraser since that night, nor he to her. Not since the final moment when, in a fury of fear and outrage, she'd screamed at him. My father would never have said such a thing. She could still see what his face had looked like when she spoke her final words to him. She wished she could forget. He had turned without a word and left the cabin. Ian had risen and quietly gone after him. Neither of them had come back that night. Her mother had stayed with her, comforting, petting, stroking her head and murmuring small soothing things as she alternately raged and sobbed. But even as her mother held Brianna's head in her lap and wiped her face with cool cloths, Bree could feel a part of her yearning toward that man, wanting to follow him, wanting to comfort him. And she blamed him for that as well. Her head throbbed with the effort of staying stone-faced. She didn't dare relax the muscles of eyes and jaw until she was sure they had left. It would be too easy to break down. She hadn't, not since that night. Once she'd pulled herself together, she had assured her mother that she was all right, insisted that Claire go to bed. She had herself sat up till dawn, eyes burning from rage and wood smoke, with the drawing of Roger on the table before her. He had come back at dawn, called her mother to him, not looking at Brianna, murmured a bit in the dooryard and sent her mother back, face hollow-eyed with worry, to pack her things. He had brought her here, down the mountain to River Run. She had wanted to go with them, had wanted to go at once to find Roger without a moment's delay. But he had been obdurate. And so had her mother. It was late December, and the winter snows lay thick on the mountainside. She was nearly 4 months gone. The taut curve of her belly was tightly rounded now. There was no telling how long the journey might take, and she was reluctantly compelled to admit that she didn't want to give birth on a raw mountainside. She might have overridden her mother's opinion, but not when it was buttressed by his stubbornness. She leaned her forehead against the cool marble of the mausoleum. It was a cold day, spitting rain, but her face felt hot and swollen as though she were coming down with a fever. She couldn't stop hearing him,
seeing him, his face congested with rage, sharp-edged as a devil's mask, his voice rough with fury and contempt, reproaching her for the loss of his bloody honour.
"Your honour," she had said incredulously, "your honour? Your fucking notion of honour is what's caused all the trouble in the first place."
"You will not use that sort of language to me, though if it's fucking we're speaking of."
"I'll fucking well say anything I want," she bellowed, and slammed a fist on the table, rattling the dishes.
She had, too. So had he. Her mother had tried once or twice to stop them. Brianna flinched at the belated memory of the distress in Claire's deep golden eyes. But neither of them had paid a moment's notice, too intent on the savagery of their mutual betrayal. Her mother had told her once that she had a Scottish temper, slow-fused but long-burning. Now she knew where it came from, but the knowledge didn't help. She put her folded arms against the tomb and rested her face on them, breathing in the faint sheep smell of the wool. It reminded her of the hand-knit sweaters her father, her real father, she thought, with a fresh burst of desolation, had liked to wear.
"Why did you have to die?"
she whispered to the hollow of damp wool. "Oh, why?" If Frank Randall hadn't died, none of this would have happened. He and Claire would still be there, in the house in Boston. Her family and her life would be intact. But her father was gone, replaced by a violent stranger, a man who had her face but couldn't understand her heart. A man who had taken both family and home from her, and, not satisfied with that, had taken love and safety too, leaving her bereft in this strange, harsh land. She pulled the shawl closer around her shoulders, shivering at the wind that cut through the loose weave. She should have brought a cloak. She had kissed her white-lipped mother goodbye, and then left, running through the dead garden, not looking at him. She'd wait here until she was sure they were gone, no matter if she froze. She heard a step on the brick path above her and stiffened, though she didn't turn around. Perhaps it was a servant or Jocasta come to persuade her inside. But it was a stride too long and a footfall too strong for any but one man. She blinked hard and gritted her teeth. She wouldn't turn around. She wouldn't. "Brianna," he said quietly behind her. She didn't answer, didn't move. He made a small snorting noise. Anger? Impatience? "I have a thing to say to you."
"Say it," she said,
and the words hurt her throat as though she'd swallowed some jagged object. It was beginning to rain again. Fresh spatters slicked the marble in front of her, and she could feel the icy pat of drops that struck through her hair.
"I will bring him home to you," Jamie Fraser said, still quiet, "or I will not come back myself."
She couldn't bring herself to turn around. There was a small sound, a click on the pavement behind her, and then the sound of his footsteps going away. Before her tear-blurred eyes, the drops on the marble roses gathered weight and began to fall. When at last she turned around, the brick-lined walk was empty. At her feet was a folded paper, damp with rain, weighted with a stone. She picked it up and held it crumpled in her hand, afraid to open it. February, 1770. In spite of worry and anger, she found herself easily absorbed into the flow of daily life at River Run. Her great-aunt, delighted at her company, encouraged her to find distraction. Finding that she had some skill in drawing, Jocasta had brought out her own painting equipment, urging Brianna to make use of it. By comparison with the cabin on the ridge, life at River Run was so luxurious as to be almost decadent. Still, Brianna awoke at dawn, out of habit. She stretched languorously, wallowing in the physical delight of a feather bed that embraced and yielded to her every move. A definite contrast to lumpy quilts spread over a chilly straw tick. There was a fire burning on the hearth,
the large copper can on the washstand, its burnished sides glowing. Hot water for washing. She could see the tiny shimmers of heat wavering over the metal. There was still a chill in the room, and the light outside was winter blue with cold. The servant who had come and gone in silence must have risen in the black pre-dawn and broken ice to get the water.
"She ought to feel guilty at being waited on by slaves," she thought drowsily. "She must remember to, later." There were a lot of things she didn't mean to think about until later. One more wouldn't hurt. For now, she was warm. Far away, she could hear small noises in the house, a comforting scuffle of domesticity. The room itself was wrapped in silence, the occasional pop of kindling from the fire the only sound. She rolled onto her back, and mind still half afloat in sleep, began to reacquaint herself with her body. This was a morning ritual, something she had begun to do half-consciously as a teenager, and found necessary to do on purpose now, to find and make peace with the small changes of the night, lest she look suddenly during the day and find herself a stranger in her own body. One stranger in her body was enough, she thought. She pushed the bedclothes down, running her hands slowly over the dormant swell of her stomach. A tiny ripple ran across her flesh as the inhabitant stretched, turning slowly as she had turned in the bed a few moments before, enclosed and embraced. "Hi there," she said softly. The bulge flexed briefly against her hand and then fell still. The occupant returned to its mysterious dreams. Slowly she ruffled up the nightgown. It was Jocasta's, warm, soft flannel, registering the smooth, long muscle at the top of each thigh, the soft hollow curving in at the top, then up and down and over, bare skin to bare skin, palms to legs and belly and breasts, smooth and soft, round and hard, muscle and bone, but now not all her muscle and bone. Her skin felt different in the morning, like a snake's skin, newly shed, all tender and light lucent. Later, when she rose, when the air got at it, it would be harder, a duller but more serviceable envelope. She lay back against the pillow, watching the light fill the room. The house was awake beyond her. She could hear the myriad faint noises of people at work and felt soothed. When she was small, she would wake on summer mornings to hear the chatter of her father's lawnmower underneath her window, his voice calling out in greeting to a neighbour. She had felt safe, protected, knowing he was there. More recently she had waked at dawn and heard Jamie Fraser's voice speaking in soft Gaelic to his horses outside, and had felt that same feeling return with a rush. No more, though. It had been true, what her mother said. She was removed, changed, altered without consent or knowledge, learning only after the fact. She threw aside the quilts and got up. She couldn't lie in bed mourning what was lost. It was no longer anyone's job to protect her. The job of protector was hers now. The baby was a constant presence, and, oddly enough, a constant reassurance. For the first time she felt blessing in it, and an odd reconciliation. Her body had known this long before her mind. So that was true, too. Her mother had said it often. Listen to your body. She leaned against the window frame, looking out on the patchy snow that lay on the kitchen garden. A slave, muffled in cloak and scarf, was kneeling on the path, digging overwintered carrots from one of the beds. Tall elms bordered the walled garden. Somewhere beyond those stark bare branches lay the mountains. She stayed still, listening to the rhythms of her body. The intruder in her flesh stirred a little, the tides of its movement merging with the pulsing of her blood, their blood. In the beating of her heart, she thought she heard the echo of that other, smaller heart, and in the sound found at last the courage to think clearly, with the assurance that if the worst happened, she pressed hard against the window frame and felt it creak under the force of her urgency.
If the worst happened, still she would not be totally alone. Chapter 53. Blame. Jamie spoke barely a word to anyone between our departure from Fraser's Ridge and our arrival at the Tuscaroran village of Tanago. I rode in a state of misery, torn between guilt at leaving Brianna, fear for Roger, and pain at Jamie's silence. He was short with Ian, and had said no more than absolutely necessary to Jocasta at Cross Creek. To me, he said nothing. Plainly, he blamed me for not telling him at once about Stephen Bonnet. In retrospect, I blamed myself bitterly, seeing what had come of it. He had kept the gold ring I had thrown at him. I had no idea what he had done with it. The weather was intermittently bad, the clouds hanging so low to the mountains that on the higher ridges we travelled for days on end through a thick, cold fog, water droplets condensing on the horses' coats so that a constant rain dripped from their manes and moisture shone on their flanks. We slept at night in whatever shelter we could find, each rolled in a damp cocoon of blankets, lying separately around a smouldering fire. Some of the Indians who had known us at Anauka made us welcome when we reached Tanago. I saw several men eye the casks of whiskey as we unloaded our pack mules, but no one made any move to molest them. There were 2 mule loads of whiskey, 12 small casks, all of the Fraser share of the year's distilling, most of our income for the year. A king's ransom in terms of trade. Enough to ransom one young Scotsman, I hoped. It was the best and the only thing we had to trade with, but it was also a dangerous one. Jamie presented one cask to the sachem of the village, and he and Ian disappeared into one of the longhouses to confer. Ian had given Roger to some of his friends among the Tuscarora, but didn't know where they had taken him. I hoped against hope that it was Tanago. If so, we could be back at River Run within a month. This was a faint hope, though. In the midst of the bitter quarrel with Brianna, Jamie had admitted telling Ian to make sure that Roger didn't come back again. Tanago was about 10 days' journey from the ridge, much too close for the purposes of an enraged father. I wanted to ask the women who entertained me about Roger, but no one in the house had any French or English, and I had only enough words of Tuscaroran to allow for basic politeness. Better to let Ian and Jamie handle the diplomatic negotiations. Jamie, with his gift for languages, was competent in Tuscaroran. Ian, who spent half his time hunting with the Indians, was thoroughly fluent. One of the women offered me a platter containing steaming mounds of grain cooked with fish. I learned to scoop up a bit with the flat piece of wood provided for the purpose, and felt the amulet swing forward under my shirt, its small weight both a reminder of grief and a comfort to it. I had brought both Nyawenni's amulet and the carved opal I had found under the red cedar tree. I had brought the former, intending to give it back, to whom I had no idea. The latter might augment the whiskey if additional bargaining power was needed. For the same reason, Jamie had brought every small valuable he possessed, not many, with the exception of his father's ruby ring, which Brianna had brought to him from Scotland. We had left the ruby with Brianna, just in case we didn't return. The possibility had to be faced. There was no telling whether Gilles Duncan had been right or wrong in her theories regarding the use of gemstones, but at least Brianna would have one. She had hugged me fiercely and kissed me when we left River Run. I hadn't wanted to go, nor had I wanted to stay. I was torn between them once more, between the necessity to stay and look after Brianna, and the equally urgent necessity to go with Jamie. "You have to go," Brianna had said firmly. "I'll be fine. You said yourself I'm healthy as a horse. You'll be back a long time before I need you." She had glanced at her father's back. He stood in the stable yard, supervising the loading of the horses and mules. She turned back to me, expressionless. "You have to go, Mama. I trust you to find Roger." There was an uncomfortable emphasis on the "you," and I hoped very much that Jamie couldn't hear it. "Surely you don't think Jamie would—" "I don't know," she interrupted. "I don't know what he'd do." Her jaw was set in a way I recognized all too well. Argument was futile, but I tried anyway.
"Well, I know," I said firmly. "He'd do anything for you, Brianna, anything. And even if it weren't you, he'd do everything he possibly could to get Roger back. His sense of honor..."
Her face shut up like a trap, and I realized my mistake.
"His honor," she said flatly. "That's what matters. I guess it's all right, though, as long as it makes him get Roger back."
She turned away, bending her head against the wind. "Brianna," I said. But she only hunched her shoulders, pulling the shawl tight around them.
"Auntie Claire, we're ready now."
Ian had appeared nearby, glancing from me to Brianna, his face troubled. I looked from him to Brianna, hesitating, not wanting to leave her like this.
"Bree," I said again.
Then she had turned back in a flurry of wool and embraced me, her cheek cold against mine.
"Come back," she whispered. "Oh, Mama, come back safe."
"I can't leave you, Bree, I can't." I held her tight, all strong bone and tender flesh. The child I had left, the child I had regained, and the woman who now put my arms away from her and stood straight, alone.
"You have to go," she whispered.
The mask of indifference had fallen and her cheeks were wet. She glanced over my shoulder at the archway to the stable yard.
"Bring him back. You're the only one who can bring him back."
She kissed me quickly, turned and ran, the sound of her steps ringing on the brick path. Jamie came through the stable arch and saw her, flying through the stormy light like a banshee. He stood still, looking after her, his face expressionless.
"You can't leave her like this," I said.
I wiped my own wet cheeks with the corner of my shawl.
"Jamie, go after her. Please, go and say goodbye, at least."
He stood still for a moment, and I thought he was going to pretend he hadn't heard me. But then he turned and walked slowly down the path. The first drops of rain were beginning to fall, splatting on the dusty brick, and the wind belled his cloak as he went.
"Auntie."
Ian's hand was under my arm, gently urging. I went with him and let him give me a hand under my foot to mount. Within a few minutes, Jamie was back. He had mounted, not looking at me, and with a signal to Ian, ridden out of the stable yard without looking back.
I had looked back, but there was no sign of Brianna.
Night had long since fallen, and Jamie was still in the longhouse with Nacognawito and the sachem of the village. I looked up whenever anyone came into the house, but it was never him. At length, though, the hide flap over the doorway lifted, and Ian came in, a small round figure behind him.
"I've a surprise for you, Auntie," he said, beaming,
and stepped aside to show me the smiling round face of the slave woman, Polly Ann. Or rather, the ex-slave. For here, of course, she was free. She sat down beside me, grinning like a jack-o'-lantern, and turned back the deerskin mantle she wore to show me the little boy in the crook of her arm, his face as round and beaming as her own. With Ian as interpreter, her own bits of English and Gaelic and the odd bit of female sign language, we were soon deep in conversation. She had, as Myers surmised, been welcomed by the Tuscaroans and adopted into the tribe where her skills at healing were valued. She had taken as husband a man who had been widowed in the measles epidemic and had presented him with this new addition to the family a few months before. I was delighted that she had found both freedom and happiness, and congratulated her warmly. I was reassured, too. If the Tuscarorans had treated her so kindly, perhaps Roger hadn't fared as badly as I feared. A thought struck me, and I pulled Nyawenni's amulet from the neck of my buckskin shirt. "Ian, will you ask if she knows who I should give this to?" He spoke to her in Tuscaroran, and she leaned forward, fingering the amulet curiously as he spoke. At last she shook her head and sat back, replying in her curious deep voice.
"She says they will not want it, Auntie," Ian translated.
It is the medicine bundle of a shaman, and it is dangerous. It should have been buried with the person to whom it belonged. No one here will touch it for fear of attracting the shaman's ghost.
I hesitated, holding the leather pouch in my hand. The strange sense of holding something alive had not recurred since Nyoene's death. Surely it was no more than imagination that seemed to stir against my palm. Ask her, what if the shaman wasn't buried, if the body couldn't be found? Polly Ann's round face was solemn, listening. She shook her head when Ian had finished and replied,
"She says that in that case the ghost walks with you, Auntie. She says you shouldn't show it to anyone here. They will be frightened."
"She isn't frightened, is she?" Polly Ann caught that on her own. She shook her head and touched her massive bosom.
"Indian now," she said simply. "Not always."
She turned to Ian and explained through him that her own people revered the spirits of the dead. In fact, it wasn't unusual for a man to keep by him the head or some other part of his grandfather or other ancestor for protection or advice. No, the thought of a ghost walking with me didn't trouble her. Nor did the notion trouble me. In fact, I found the thought of Nyoene walking with me to be rather a comfort under the circumstances. I put the amulet back in my shirt. It brushed soft and warm against my skin, like the touch of a friend. We talked for some time, until long after the others in the longhouse had gone to their separate cubicles, and the sound of snoring filled the smoky air. We were surprised, in fact, by Jamie's arrival, which let in a draught of cold air. It was as Polly Ann made her farewells that she hesitated, trying to decide whether to tell me something. She glanced at Jamie, then shrugged her massive shoulders and made up her mind. She leaned close to Ian, murmured something that sounded like honey trickling over rocks, putting both hands to her face, fingertips against the skin. She then embraced me quickly and left. Ian stared after her in astonishment. "What did she say, Ian?" He turned back to me, his sketchy brows drawn together in concern.
"She says I should tell Uncle Jimmy that the night the woman died in the sawmill, she saw a man."
"What man?"
He shook his head, still frowning. "She didn't ken him, only that he was a white man, heavy and square, not so tall as Uncle or I. She saw him come out of the mill and walk fast into the forest. She was sitting in the door to her hut, in the dark, so she thinks he didn't see her. But he passed close enough to the fire that she saw his face. She says he was pockmarked." Here he put his fingertips against his face as she had, "with a face like a pig."
"Murchison?"
My heart skipped a beat. "Did the man wear a uniform?" Jamie asked, frowning.
"No, but she was curious to know what he'd been doing there. He wasn't one of the plantation owners, nor yet a hand or an overseer. So she crept to the mill to see. But when she put her head inside, she knew something evil had happened. She said she smelt blood, and then she heard voices, so she didn't go in."
So it had been murder, and Jamie and I had missed preventing it by a matter of moments. It was warm in the longhouse, but I felt cold at the memory of the thick, bloody air in the sawmill and the hardness of a kitchen skewer in my hand. Jamie's hand settled on my shoulder. Without thinking, I reached up and took it. It felt very good in mine, and I realized that we hadn't purposely touched each other in nearly a month.
"The dead lass was an army laundress," he said quietly. "Murchison has a wife in England. I suppose he might have found a pregnant mistress to be an encumbrance."
"No wonder he was making such a fuss of hunting for whoever was responsible. And then seizing on yon poor woman who couldn't even speak for herself."
Ian's face was flushed with indignation.
"If he could have got her hanged for it, he'd have thought himself safe, I dare say, the wicked wee scut."
"Perhaps I will pay a call on the sergeant when we return," Jamie said, "privately."
The thought made my blood run cold. His voice was soft and even, and his face calm when I turned to look, but I seemed to see the surface of a dark Scottish pool reflected in his eyes. The water ruffled as though something heavy had just sunk below.
"Don't you think you've enough vengeance to keep you occupied for the moment?"
I spoke more sharply than I intended, and his hand slipped abruptly out of mine.
"I expect so,"
he said, both face and voice without expression. He turned to Ian.
"Wakefield or Mackenzie or whatever the man's name is a good way to the north. They sold him to the Mohawk, a small village below the river. Your friend, Onakara, has agreed to guide us. We'll leave at first light."
He rose and walked away toward the far end of the house. Everyone else had already retired for the night. Five hearths burned down the length of the house, each with its own smoke hole, and the far wall was divided into cubicles, one for each couple or family, with a low, wide shelf for sleeping, and space beneath for storage. Jamie stopped at the cubicle assigned for our use, where I had left our cloaks and bundles. He slipped off his boots, unbelted the plaid he wore over breeches and shirt, and disappeared into the darkness of the sleeping space without a backward glance. I scrambled to my feet, meaning to follow him, but Ian stopped me with a hand on my arm.
"Auntie," he said hesitantly, "will you not forgive him?"
"Forgive him?" I stared at him. "For what? For Roger?" He grimaced.
"No. It was a grievous mistake, but we would do the same again, thinking matters as we did. No, for Bonnet."
"For Stephen Bonnet? How can he possibly think I blame him for that? I've never said such a thing to him. And I'd been too busy thinking that he blamed me even to consider it." Ian scratched a hand through his hair.
"Well, do you not see, Auntie? He blames himself for it. He has, ever since the man robbed us on the river, and now what he's done to my cousin."
He shrugged, looking mildly embarrassed.
"He's fair eaten up with it, and knowing that you're angry with him."
"But I'm not angry with him. I thought he was angry with me because I didn't tell him Bonnet's name right away."
"Ugh."
Ian looked as though he didn't know whether to laugh or look distressed.
"Well, I dare say it would have saved us a bit of trouble if you had. But no, I'm sure it's not that, Auntie. After all, by the time Cousin Brianna told you, we'd already met yon Mackenzie on the mountainside and done him a bit of no good."
I took in a deep breath and blew it out again. "But you think he thinks I'm angry with him?"
"Oh, anyone could see you are, Auntie,"
he assured me earnestly.
"You dinna look at him or speak to him, say for what you must. And,"
he said, clearing his throat delicately,
"I've not seen you go to his bed any time this month past."
"Well, he hasn't come to mine either," I said hotly, before reflecting that this was scarcely a suitable conversation to be having with a 17-year-old boy. Ian hunched his shoulders and gave me an owlish look.
"Well, he's his pride, hasn't he?"
"God knows he has," I said, rubbing a hand over my face.
Look, Ian, thank you for saying something to me."
He gave me one of the rare, sweet smiles that transformed his long, homely face.
"Well, I do hate to see him suffer. I'm fond of Uncle Jamie, eh?"
"So am I," I said, and swallowed the small lump in my throat. "Good night, Ian." I walked softly down the length of the house, past cubicles in which whole families slept together, the sound of their mingled breathing a peaceful descant to the anxious beating of my heart. It was raining outside. Water dripped from the smoke holes, sizzling in the embers. Why hadn't I seen what Ian had? That was easy to answer. It wasn't anger, but my own sense of guilt that had blinded me. I had kept back my knowledge of Bonnet's involvement as much because of the gold wedding ring as because Brianna had asked me to. I could have persuaded her to tell Jamie had I tried. She was right. He would undoubtedly go after Stephen Bonnet sooner or later. I had somewhat more confidence in Jamie's success than she did, though. No, it had been the ring that had made me keep silence. And why should I feel guilty over that? There was no sensible answer. It had been instinct, not conscious thought, to hide the ring. I hadn't wanted to show it to Jamie, to put it back on my finger in front of him. And yet I had wanted, needed, to keep it. My heart squeezed small, thinking of the past few weeks, of Jamie going grimly about the necessities of reparation in loneliness and guilt. That was why I'd come with him, after all, because I was afraid that if he went alone, he might not come back. Spurred by guilt and courage, he might go to reckless lengths. With me to consider, I knew he would be careful. And all the time he had thought himself not only alone, but bitterly reproached by the one person who could and should have offered him comfort. Eaten up with it, indeed. I paused by the cubicle. The shelf was some 8 feet wide, and he lay well back. I could see little more of him than a humped shape under a blanket made of rabbit skins. He lay very still, but I knew he wasn't asleep. I climbed onto the platform, and once safe within the shadows of the cubicle, slipped out of my clothes. It was fairly warm in the longhouse, but my bare skin prickled and my nipples tightened. My eyes had grown accustomed to the dimness. I could see that he lay on his side, facing me. I caught the shine of his eyes in the dark, open and watching me. I knelt down and slid under the blanket, the fur soft against my skin. Without stopping to think too much, I rolled to face him, pressing my nakedness against him, face buried in his shoulder. "Jamie," I whispered to him, "I'm cold. Come and warm me. Please." He turned to me, wordless, but with a quiet ferocity that I might have thought the hunger of desire long stifled, but knew now for simple desperation. I sought no pleasure for myself. I wanted only to give him comfort. But opening to him, urging him, some deep wellspring opened too, and I cleaved to him in a sudden need as blind and desperate as his own. We clung tight together, shuddering, heads buried in each other's hair, unable to look at each other, unable to let go. Slowly, as the spasms died away, I became aware of things outside our own small mortal coil, and realized that we lay in the midst of strangers, naked and helpless, shielded only by darkness. And yet we were alone, completely. We had the privacy of Babel. There was a conversation going on at the far end of the longhouse, but its words held no meaning. It might as well have been the hum of bees. Smoke from the banked fire wavered up outside the sanctuary of our bed, fragrant and insubstantial as incense. It was dark as a confessional inside the cubicle. I could see no more of Jamie than the faint curve of light that rimmed his shoulder, a transient gleam in the locks of his hair. "Jamie, I'm sorry," I said softly. "It wasn't your fault." "Who else?" he said, with some bleakness. "Everyone. No one. Stephen Bonnet himself, but not you."
"Bonnet?"
His voice was blank with surprise.
"What has he to do with it?"
"Well, everything," I said, taken aback.
"Doesn't he?"
He rolled halfway off me, brushing hair out of his face.
"Stephen Bonnet is a wicked creature," he said precisely, "and I shall kill him at the first opportunity I have. But I dinna see how I can blame him for my own failings as a man."
"What on earth are you talking about? What failings?" He didn't answer right away, but bent his head, a humped shadow in the dark. His legs were still entangled with mine. I could feel the tension of his body, knotted in his joints, rigid in the hollows of his thighs.
"I hadn't thought ever to be so jealous of a dead man," he whispered at last. "I shouldn't have thought it possible."
"Of a dead man?" My own voice rose slightly with astonishment as it finally dawned on me. "Of Frank?" He lay still, half on top of me, His hand touched the bones of my face, hesitant.
Who else? I've been worm-eaten with you all these days of riding. I see his face in my...